Welcome to Common Ground Radio, an hour-long discussion of local food and organic agriculture with people in Maine and beyond, brought to you by the Maine Organic Farmers and Gardeners Association in conjunction with WERU, your community radio station. Common Ground Radio can be heard on the second Thursday of each month at 4 p.m. on 89.9 FM and at weru.org. My name is Holly Cederholm, and I'm your host for today. With spring on the horizon, we'll be discussing garden planning for seasonal eating. Up first, I'll be speaking with Roberta Bailey. Roberta grows much of her food on Seven Tree Farm in Vassalboro, Maine. She has eaten with the season since the late 1970s and writes about it in the Harvest Kitchen column in Mofka's quarterly publication called The Maine Organic Farmer and Gardener. Roberta, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Holly. It's a pleasure to be here. Looking forward to spring.
Yeah, me too. So today we're talking about planning your garden for cooking and eating and preserving. As the recipe columnist for the Maine Organic Farmer and Gardener, you've been writing about seasonal eating for 40 years. Your approach to seasonal eating involves growing and putting by a lot of your own food to eat throughout the year. And I was hoping you could start by telling us a little bit about your garden.
Well, I plant food for the home garden in three plots that are 70 by 100. I'm not planting all of them all at once. It's more, some places I do an early crop and then it's in a cover crop. So don't feel like you have to have that much space to grow a lot of food for yourself. I'm growing things like corn for flour and barley and soybeans and things like that for a lot of different forms of using the soy. I start planting in April. It kind of depends on the year and how wet or cold it is. But the first things that go in the ground are spinach. And at that time, we're also eating asparagus from a perennial bed. And then after that comes beets and chard and lots of Asian greens. And then there's putting in the onion seedlings, which can go in really early in late April or early May. And this is all dependent on your area too, you know, and if you have wet ground or dry ground, things like that.
First, let's hear a little bit more about your specific location. I know the zones have changed recently, the USDA plant hardiness zones, and those might be unfamiliar to folks. What is your frost-free window, and maybe what kind of soil type do you have to orient folks to your specific site?
I have Buxton silt loam. I'm in Vassalboro, which is not too far from the Kennebec River between Augusta and Waterville. I don't know what my current zone is, but I would say our ground has a lot of clay in it, and then there's a hot clay hard pan under it, so it's not well drained. And in years past, that served me very well. These days, with like last summer, I think I had standing water in my gardens the entire year, except for a short window in spring where we actually were kind of dry. I'm a little cold and wet. You know, I have a ridge behind me and the cold runs down to me, but I can still plant. I start planting in April and I do cover things with row cover to protect them in the spring. And also because I have chickens ranging everywhere. And at first I just plant a few things and just cover those over so that the chickens can still have time before they get fenced for the season.
When you're approaching garden planning, thinking back to the things that you already mentioned that you're putting in starting in the spring, how do you decide which crops that you're going to plant? So some of those things are perennial, like your asparagus patch, but then you mentioned some of the early things that you're growing, like spinach. What is the determining factor or set of factors for how you approach crop planning?
I plant the things that will tolerate cold and cool nights first, and even damp or wet soils. Spinach, chard, kale, onions, leeks, you know, any of the alliums, beets, and carrots, they go in first because they can tolerate colder temperatures, and their seed germinates well in cooler temperatures. Warmer crops like peppers and tomatoes, you should really wait till your ground is as close to 60 degrees as you can get it. In the case of cucumbers, if you put them in earlier, they're just going to curl up and die. Other things will just sit there, and sometimes they'll actually yellow because their roots can't get the nutrients out of the ground. The soil is just too cold for them. So it's worth waiting. You know, I think in spring, we all want to start seedlings. We all want to get out there and plant. But to me, I feel like it's a game of patience and waiting till the right time when the soil is warm enough.
And so you mentioned you're starting with seedlings. In that case, are you growing these indoors? Do you have a hoop house? What does your seedling setup look like?
I start my early seedlings, onions and parsley and celery. I have a sunroom on my house, so I use that for early seedlings and even my peppers. So the onions, I wait until the beginning of March to start anything. And right now, well, I have onions, all of my alliums like shallots and leeks, and then celery and parsley started now in March, early March. And then by mid-March or the third week of March, I'll start peppers. These are in like little flats that I'm almost planting rows like a garden. And I leave those in my sunroom, which is attached to the house and heated easily, until they start to get their first set of true leaves. And that's usually, if I'm starting in mid-March, then they're ready to transplant by late March or the very beginning of April. And then I shift out to we have a greenhouse. It's a post and beam cedar framed greenhouse with polycarbonate panels on it. And it's pretty good. It's heated by propane, but if the temperatures get 25 degrees or lower at night, I have to add extra heat, like another electric heater or something. Sometimes I'll make a little row cover hoop house over my seedlings and put a heater underneath that just so that I can sleep at night if the temps are going to be low. So then from there, from the greenhouse, everything stays in there, you know, till they're ready to go out. Sometimes as late as mid-June before I'm putting out, you know, the real tender squash and melons and even peppers some years. One thing I've noticed in some of the Facebook gardening groups is people are asking left and right, what do I start when? What do I start when? I'll give you my central main wet ground starting schedule. For a high tunnel, I might start plugs in late February. For regular gardening, early March, I do all of my alliums, you know, onions, shallots, leeks, and parsley and celery. Those celery and parsley take almost a month to germinate. And then in mid-March, I'll start peppers. Late March or early April, tomatoes, and then mid-April, brassicas. And perennials, you might want to start, you know, perennial things really early in March. And then for things like squash and cucurbits, early May. And I also start some corn in plugs in early May for a little, you know, little jump on the season too. So that's my basic schedule of seedling planting.
So I want to talk a little bit about some of your personal determinations for what crops you grow, aside from, you know, what does well in your soil and what the succession of like the cold tolerant to the less cold tolerant and how you move things along through the season. You wrote an article called How to Plan Your Harvest for Food Preservation, which details how you determine how much to plant for each crop, whether it's peas or broccoli or tomatoes. In the article, you write that you first consider what you like to eat. And you also go on to think about not only what you like to eat, but how you like to prepare it. And I'm thinking about tomatoes, for instance, you might not want big, juicy tomatoes if you're just going to make sauce out of them. You might want something that is a little bit meaty and less juicy. So I was wondering if you could talk about your approach that's really founded in your kitchen and how that applies to your garden.
As far as what you like to eat or how you like to eat it, if you don't eat a lot of pickles, then don't grow a huge cucumber patch and put up all these pickles, especially if they end up being soft or something and you don't like them. It's truly just a waste of time. So, you know, think about how you like to eat something. I eat a lot of edamame. I don't like to blanch it and then freeze it in the hulls. So I blanch like 5 gallon buckets of edamame, soybean in the hulls. And then I sit there and shell them all. And then I have bags, small bags of soybeans, green soybeans that are sweet and nutty and delicious in the freezer to use quite readily. Whereas the ones that I throw in there in the hulls sometimes sit there until the next spring and it's like, oh, okay, I either feed them to the chickens or make myself use them. So I think about how I like to eat my food. An example would be broccoli. I don't mind it frozen, but I have a hard time getting a really good texture with it. So I do freeze it, but I chop it up very small. And I do the same with my green beans because frozen green beans sometimes can have weird textures. So, but by chopping them small, then I like to eat them. When I think about planting for my garden, you know, for putting up food, sometimes I'll just put up the surplus that I have. Like with spinach, I plant like 3 50-foot rows. And if for some reason the spinach crop doesn't do well that year, then I have the fall to try again. You know, so there's kind of an approach of putting up what's surplus you have, but you can also plan to, you know, you can plan what you need for the year. Let's take broccoli. Think about how many months of the year I'm going to want to eat broccoli. Okay, so there's broccoli in the garden until sometime in November. So December, January, February, March, and April and May, 6 months. By June, I'm eating other things and I'm not really wanting to eat as much out of the freezer. So by June, you know, there's, or even May, there's salads and things. So 6 months of the year, I want frozen broccoli. Then I think about, well, how many times a week do I want to eat broccoli? Maybe, you know, maybe I'm going to make a broccoli soup, or maybe that week you don't eat so much, but say two. So you've got 4 weeks, you know, you've got 20, say you've got 24 weeks and you're eating 2 bags a week. So more or less, you want to have 50 bags of broccoli. And then, you know, you think about, well, how much broccoli are you putting in a bag? Now I just live, my husband and I, so I tend to do 2 servings or maybe a little extra, you know, a little tiny bit more, but 2 servings works out perfectly. If you have a family, if you have guests, you take out 2 bags, something like that. So with 50 bags of broccoli, then it's kind of a guess as to what, you know, how many plants you're going to need. I sort of think about, okay, a head of broccoli will give me 2 bags or maybe 3 bags with, you know, and then there's side shoots and things. But I tend to err on the side of have surplus versus not enough. So I would say about 25 heads. And if you pay attention from year to year, you'll find that, oh, okay, 25 plants was way too much in my garden and the way we eat or this or that. And I had way too much broccoli left over in the spring. So the next year, you change that number. And that works with tomatoes and things like that too. I used to plant 100, you know, when I had my kids at home, I would plant 100 paste tomatoes every year, you know, and just put up so much tomato. Now I'll do 30 or 40, but That's because we're eating more stewed tomatoes and less sauce, you know. So you have to pay attention to what your needs are. And then some years I like to plan for environmental weirdnesses. You know, some year, like last year, a lot of people had a poor tomato crop because it was cold and rainy. My yields weren't as high, but I did okay. And I did have surplus from the year before. So it's okay if you err on the side of a lot and then put up everything you have. Then the next year, maybe you plant less. So it's sort of, there's sort of an ebb and flow or a back and forth and an adjustment from year to year as to how much you plant.
It seems like you must keep pretty good records of both your garden and yields and also sort of like a kitchen inventory. I'm wondering if you can speak to how you track these things so that you can reflect on them from year to year.
I used to keep it all in my head. Now I find that there's a row in the garden. It's like, what is that? I don't even remember what I planted. Part of my inventory is really what's left in the spring. You know, in the spring, I sort through the freezer and I get rid of anything that's more than a couple years old. I start doing it in March because that way I can feed some things to my chickens and whatnot. It's really in my head, but one could easily write down, you know, how many plants you planted one year and what the yields are. I do have charts from a number of different farmer friends and myself of how many quarts you get out of a bushel, you know, in case you're actually buying something or, you know, a bushel of tomatoes or something like that, how many quarts you would get from that. You can actually find that information through the extension service or from various charts online. I keep a daily farm journal and I know when I've planted things. And as far as yields and things, I really just go with the flow, you know. So you can track, it's probably a good idea if you're starting out to really track how many plants and what you got out of it so that you know from year to year.
I'm wondering if you might give us sort of like a tour of your pantry, so to speak. You mentioned a freezer, but I'm wondering if you can kind of paint a picture of, you know, what your harvest stores look like coming out of the growing season.
Sure. Well, I have four freezers, and one is berries. You know, we put up probably 15 gallons of raspberries and 15 or so gallons of blueberries. And some of those I tend to not make jams and things in the summertime when it's hot. I'll start doing them in the late fall, early winter when things have slowed down a bit. And then I just start pulling. I have an upstairs pantry and a cellar pantry. The upstairs one is just little bits of everything. So there's pickled peppers, there's hot pepper relish, and like hot pepper purees, which I use to spice up just about anything, especially a quesadilla or eggs in the morning or something like that. There's juice. I make blackberry elderberry juice and raspberry juice, and sometimes I'll can cider, sometimes I freeze it. Tomatoes, I do stewed tomatoes and sauces and salsa. I do a salsa verde. That's a tomatillo-based salsa, and then I do a red salsa. I've actually started freezing my salsas more because they taste a little fresher. So that's a shift too. You know, it's like, okay, I made all these salsas in jars, and now I'm getting tired of that flavor. How do I like my salsa? I like the fresh taste of the frozen salsa. It's a little watery, but I can strain it off a bit too, or mix something else into it. Let's see. So my freezers have greens. We have two meat freezers. And then we have a berry freezer, or really have one and a half meat freezers, a berry freezer, and then one that's all greens. And how I decide about what goes in the freezer is for greens is like spinach goes in. Sometimes I'll freeze Asian greens, but I don't think that I do that well with them. So, you know, so I'll do a little of those, but I tend to just eat those fresh and seasonally. I do have a high tunnel, so that extends my season. Broccoli, we like broccoli frozen. Green beans or pole beans especially, we'll freeze those. I make soups and I make like tomato soup, and I'll put dry beans that are cooked in my tomato soups, and those are pressure canned. I really think about how we eat something. Like, you know, drying food like broccoli, it doesn't reconstitute well, whereas corn or peas dried reconstitute really well. But I do freeze corn and I freeze peas, lots of peas. 500 row feet of shell peas will make 100 bags of shelled peas. And, you know, a 5-gallon bucket will give you about 10 bags of shelled peas. That's something that I try to do every single year, is 100 bags of peas, because that's our favorite vegetable.
What is the, when you say bag, is it like a 8-ounce bag, 12-ounce bag? Do you have a sense of like what the size?
It's really like 3 servings. So it's probably like a cup and a half, or almost sometimes 2 cups in a bag. And I freeze soybeans, and then I do a lot of zucchini puree, because zucchini itself frozen, I've tried so many different ways, it really doesn't work out well. But zucchini puree, I'll steam it with some onions and then blend it and freeze it in either wide mouth pint jars or yogurt containers or something like that. And I use that as part of my stock for soups. And it's sort of a hidden little bit of richness that helps with the the background flavor of the soup, and yet you don't really detect it. So I put up a lot of stock, you know, that I've made from chicken. We raise chickens, so, or vegetable stocks and things like that as well.
You are listening to Common Ground Radio on WERU 89.9 FM. I'm Holly Cederholm, and on today's show, we're talking about how to plan your organic garden to meet your kitchen needs. I'm currently talking with Roberta Bailey, who writes the Harvest Kitchen column for the Maine Organic Farmer and Gardener. You can read the publication online or become a subscriber at mofga.org. Sounds like a very robust array that you have stored there. Thank you for sharing that.
We also have, I have a root cellar. My root cellar is just a corner of my concrete walled cellar. So it's an insulated room, and there's just one vent pipe out to the outside. It's a PVC pipe, and that lets cold in. We have had to start cooling it down with air conditioner that has a cool bot on it, because the falls are getting so warm for so long that apples and carrots and things that need to get cooled down, and the cellars are too warm now. So we've installed an air conditioner with a cool bot, and that keeps it at about 40 degrees, which really makes a difference. So in the cellar, I'll keep my onions and garlic, carrots, beets, leeks, apples, potatoes. I know I don't have a system where I can store apples and potatoes separately, but they are in crates with trash bags over them, so they're sealed. And that I'm hoping that that helps them, the ethanol gases that the potatoes release, not soften the apples. And right now, you know, we're in March and I still have very hard apples, so it is working. Squash, I keep it in my mudroom because that doesn't go below 40 degrees, but I think it's pretty happy in like dark, dry, 55, 60 degrees. You know, the classic rule is store it in your spare bedroom under the bed, you know, a room that's not heated but doesn't freeze. So yeah, I very rarely have to buy anything from a store. And having a high tunnel has really changed our eating habits as well. I don't have to freeze as much greens because we're eating spinach and kale year round that's fresh out of the high tunnel. And that I noticed that was like, oh, we ate less broccoli. You know, the first year I had it was like, oh, we ate less broccoli. You know, so it's all about paying attention to the ebb and flow of your diet, you know, and what you actually end up needing.
For folks who are either new to gardening or new to sort of thinking about their garden as a year-round supply of food, the way that you really do, what tips or advice do you have in addition to really thinking about what you eat and how you like to eat it?
I would say plant extra, you know, and that way you have enough. And if you have extra, then you can do something else with it or give it away or feed it to your chickens or trade it, you know, and that way it meets my needs of having enough, you know, especially things like squash, because the yields can be so subject and sensitive to the gardening year or the bug pressure or powdery mildew or wilts that come in. Or lately I've been getting squash borer, you know, vine borers. So plant extra. And then think hard about how you eat things and put them up in that form. Like the pickle example. If you don't eat a lot of pickles, don't can a lot of pickles then, you know. Start with what you love.
This is a tough question, but you said many things that you really like, edamame, broccoli, for example. But what is like a mainstay that would just be devastating to not have in your larder?
I've never been able to answer that question because, you know, it's like, oh, tomatoes, but then you have to have the basil, you know, or oh, garlic, you know, garlic goes with everything. How could I live without garlic? But what I think about most about gardening, more than the favorite, is how sweet food tastes fresh out of the garden. You know, the classic example is corn, and, you know, like, literally going out to the garden and picking your corn and then bringing it back to the pot of boiling water, or, you know, or what, something like that. But to me, how many people know that asparagus is sweet, or that broccoli is sweet, or that spinach is sweet? And in the winter time, it's super sweet. You know, that I actually prefer not to eat kale until after it's been frosted, because then it comes into its full glory. So, more than a favorite vegetable, I think my favorite thing about gardening is the amazing flavor that comes with freshly picked vegetables. Even peas, if you leave them to the next day, the enzymes have already started to turn them into starch. So, in some ways, it's hard to know how good food is supposed to taste because you never get that anywhere else.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today and sharing more about your gardening and food preserving. It was a pleasure to have you on.
Thanks, Holly. It's been a pleasure. Good luck, everybody, in your gardening year.
For the second half of today's show, we'll be in conversation with Stephanie Wang. She specializes in growing Asian vegetables in Quebec, Canada, which has a frost-free period from early June to mid-September. In addition to growing organic vegetables, Stephanie is an author on the subject. Along with her two sisters, she recently co-wrote and published the book Asian Vegetables: Gardening, Cooking, Storytelling. It features delicious recipes as well as information about how to grow 15 Asian vegetables organically in a northern climate. Stephanie, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So, in the introduction to your newly released book, Asian Vegetables, it describes your family's journey from China to Canada by way of Madagascar, and how your family remained connected to China over years and miles through a love of food. The book says that vegetables are at the heart of Chinese cooking and goes on to describe how to grow and cook with 15 different Asian vegetables. Some, like bok choy and Chinese cabbage, are more common in mainstream food markets here in Maine, while others are less so, including luffah and amaranth greens. How did you decide which vegetables to include in your book?
Of course, we had limited space, so we kind of came to the idea that 15 vegetables would be a good number. And then for choosing which one we would present, we wanted to have a very diverse family of Asian vegetables we would present in the book. So some are easiest to grow in a cool weather setting, and some prefer warmer temperatures. So these are the two great families that we present. And then inside those family, we wanted to have some that are easy to grow and some that offer more challenge in the garden for more experimented gardeners. And also some that are well-known, like bok choy and apple cabbage, but some that are, as you mentioned, maybe less available in most of the communities. So that everyone can find something interesting.
And all of the vegetables, as you mentioned, are able to be grown in northern climates. So you have a farm in Quebec and you grow these regularly.
Yes, I've been growing them all since 2016. That's the year when I started the farm Le Rizin. The farm is actually located in Fredericksburg in the eastern townships of Quebec. So it's the southern part of Quebec. We're right near close to the border of Vermont. So of course, it's one of the warmest zone in Quebec. That's why we can successfully grow like okra and luffah and everything. But we do mention advices on how to give like some more warmth to vegetables, like using row covers or caterpillar tunnel, and of course, greenhouses.
For folks who aren't growing at the farm scale, who may have a backyard garden or even like a patio where they're growing things in containers, the book details that these are easy to adapt to any kind of growing system.
Yes, for each one of those 15 vegetables, we mention if it's a good choice for balcony or pots setting.
So which ones would you recommend for beginners, and why are those more suitable for beginner growers?
Yeah, the easiest vegetables, according to me, are the ones that are not attacked by insects or less prone to disease. So for example, edible chrysanthemum and stem lettuce, these two are cool weather vegetables. And then in the warmer, warm loving vegetables, you have amaranth leaf, Malabar spinach, lemongrass, shiso. So pretty much leafy greens that do not require too much care, attention, or frequent watering. And then you can grow without using insect netting.
And those ones seem to be some of the less common vegetables, at least for me. Some of the more advanced vegetables that are included are Chinese cabbage, which we mentioned, and okra and Asian eggplant, which I think people might be a little more familiar with. I'm wondering if you could talk to some of the leafy greens like edible chrysanthemum and amaranth. What are some of these crops and what are they used for in the kitchen?
Yes, I think the less common greens that we are talking about are maybe like edible chrysanthemum is a bit bitter. Stem lettuce has a bit of bitterness also because it's like this, the heart of the lettuce. Like Malabar spinach will have a little slimy texture. Amaranth is pretty neutral, very looks like a spinach, although it's better cooked up because when it's raw, it's a bit rough as a leaf, but it's edible. It's not toxic raw. So they have a little something, right? That basically what we are trying to do is just to say that this little something might be a bit different than the more classic vegetables that we are used to. But when you get to know how to use this specialty of this vegetable, then you can really use it in a culinary way to bring in something new to the plate. So bitterness also is good for health. Like in traditional Chinese medicine, they say bitterness is really good for the liver. And you can always balance it by using some honey or maple syrup in your dressing, for instance. So chrysanthemum green can be used in a salad. It makes really well with tomato. So either raw or in a stir fry or an omelette. Tastes a bit like parsley. So in potato salad, that would be really nice. Amaranth leaf, you use it just like spinach, better cooked up. So like in Indian curries, it would be really delicious. Or just stir fry, eating with pasta. Malabar spinach is really great for thickening soups too, but also even like cakes. On my website, I have a few recipes too available online. And there's a recipe of a Malabar spinach sponge cake. Really good.
I've never used Malabar spinach that way. I have grown it before and I've noticed that it does have a different texture than I'm used to in some other greens, but that sounds like a really interesting way to get more vegetables in.
Those Asian greens that grow in the summer heat are really great because most of the time we will, you know, fight for having lettuce throughout the season, but it goes to seed really quickly and bolts. So Malabar spinach, you sow it once in the spring and you can harvest it from the same plant throughout the whole season. So it's really interesting. And in the book, I mentioned, well, few techniques you can use to do that. And sliminess, like with okra and Malabar spinach, is also really good for health. It really helps digestion tracts and all of these special textures do have like medicinal values.
So for folks who haven't grown Malabar spinach before, I'd like to get into some of the different techniques that you outline in the book, but it grows differently than sort of the traditional spinach, which is sort of like a low growing rosette, whereas the Malabar spinach sort of has like a vining growth habit. Is that how you would describe it? Or
yeah, there are two main types of Malabar spinach that I know, at least. You have the red color one and then the green one. It's mostly the stem color. So the red will have red stem color and the leaves will be much smaller. Whereas the green one has green stem and green leaves, and the leaves are much bigger, like can go up to 4 or 5 inch tall. And for the leaf, and both of them have, the leaf is a bit thick. So a bit like if you think of an aloes or like a thick leaf plant. And the red one will climb, can climb really high. It's used for ornamental purpose. It's really beautiful in the garden. If you put a trellis, it will climb up, but it's more work for getting the leaves in order to cook it. The green one, it's really easy because it's more like a shrub. It won't grow very tall. Sometimes, like last year, I ordered seed from Johnny's and it seems like the green variety had been mix with a red one because there were some vines running, which I have not seen in the past. And my advice for more market gardeners, we do mostly the green one because you have bigger leaves and then we keep them short. So we'll in the spring see the like a whole row, and then every week we will alternate. So first week harvest from half the patch, and then this the next week harvest from the second half of the patch. So like that you alternate and you give the chance for plants to regrow. You should never harvest more than, you should always leave like 1/3 of the plant intact, like at least enough leaves and stems so that the plant can regrow.
So is the harvest technique for Malabar spinach something that you would describe as the cut and come again technique?
The way I call it flowering stem technique, because we take like a shoot along with the stem, shoot and leaves, and we cut, leaving some regrowth on that stem. So always leaving at least 2-3 leaves at the bottom of the stem, and then we cut. Yeah, cut and come again is, we have it mostly for like mezclun mix, like or mizuna, even larger mature mustards, that you would cut, but leaving the inner growth part. So that's mostly more with a knife. But for Malabar spinach, we use pruning shears to really cut because the stem might be thick. and then we bunch. So in the book, I explain that we make the conscious decision to harvest all of our greens, mostly more on a semi-mature to mature stage, so that we can bunch them with an elastic band and avoid using plastic bags, and sell them directly to customers or restaurants. So we find that it's also in terms of food sovereignty is to get more potential from each seed, because when you compare like the size of a, you know, Mizuna mesclun green compared to a full mature Mizuna plant, it's many pounds difference. I mean, up to many kilos if you let it grow really, really big. So we feel like each seed can feed so much more people when you just let it grow.
I want to circle back to that, but I want to stay on the topic of the flowering stem technique, because I think that might be a little bit different than how some people harvest other greens in their garden. Like you're saying the cut and come again, people might be familiar with if they're growing lettuce mixes or like baby arugula or something like that. And the flowering stem is used a lot throughout the book in terms of choisum and the chrysanthemum, amaranth, and shiso. So maybe you could talk a little bit about that technique in relation to other crops that you're growing as well.
Yeah, well, choisum and guaylan, because they are grown particularly for their flowering stem. So that's like the most indicated crop to harvest with this technique. So basically, we want to harvest and eat the stem along with the flowering shoot and few leaves. So like that, we use our hands mostly to be really precise in the cuts. And the first cut is really important because that will determine pretty much the rest of your harvest. And like for choisum, I explained to start harvesting when you see at least, I don't remember the exact number that I put in the book, I think 30 to 50% of the yellow flowers opening. And so you start harvesting and you leave always, can be 3 to 5 leaves at the bottom. And then you always, you cut just above one new leaf coming. So like that, you will be able to harvest side shoots, multiple side shoots. And for guaylan and choisum, once you start harvesting, you should harvest at least 2 to 3 times a week so that you avoid having shoots going to seed, which will end pretty much your harvest because the stem will become very fibrous at this stage. So it's always finding a good balancing. Also, the growth will depend on temperature. And so, yes. And for other ones like chrysanthemum, shiso, and Malabar spinach that we were talking about. So we use that technique. It's pretty much the basil technique that you would use for classic basil, right? You take the stem along with the leaves just above a new set of shoots. Yeah. That's why it makes sense for us to use that.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing that. This is Common Ground Radio on WERU FM 89.9. I'm Holly Cederholm, and I'm currently talking with organic farmer Stephanie Wang, co-author of Asian Vegetables. She wrote the book with her two sisters, Carolyn and Patricia. Asian Vegetables is part garden guide and part cookbook, interlaced with gorgeous photographs and family heritage and stories. We sort of jumped right into harvesting without starting at the beginning. Now it's March, it's the beginning of the gardening season for a lot of people. And I'm wondering, what are you starting now?
Yeah, so what we've started maybe 20th of February with the turmeric and ginger that I'm talking in the book, because at the farm we will grow this season, I counted at least 40 varieties of Asian vegetables. So way much more than the 15 that we present in the book. So we started turmeric, ginger, sweet potatoes. So we buy stems of turmeric, ginger, and sweet potatoes and just put it on a wet, warm soil and wait for it to sprout. And then at that point, you can divide. Or for sweet potato, you take cuttings of the leaves. You take cuttings and put it in your small pot for multiplication. And then ginger and turmeric, we break into small pieces, maybe 2 inch, and then put it on the soil. And then when it starts sprouting, you just move it into a pot. And then just more recently, we sowed the lemongrass because it also takes more time for growing. And we started the sweet peppers. So, and then in April, we will pretty much sow all the rest. We start that indoor in a grow tent because now it's still cold for us. So we have not started a greenhouse. So the most that we can start indoor in a grow tent and then move slowly to toward them. We have a caterpillar tunnel in the greenhouse. So at first we heat only that little caterpillar tunnel in the greenhouse. So to have lower cost of heating.
So you have a focus on Asian vegetables on the farm, and you also just mentioned some environmental concerns around plastic use and also some seed sovereignty interests. So I'm wondering, what are sort of the motivating factors in your crop plan? Like, how do you decide what to grow? Is it based on what you like to eat and preserve? Is it based on what markets you have? I'm sort of wondering if you could just recap how you decide which crops and varieties to grow.
Yeah, it's a bit of a mix of all everything you mentioned. Of course, like now we're starting our 9th season, so we kind of know what our customers like and also what grows well in our context, because we've tried many things and we keep trying every year new varieties. And of course, we assess at the end of the season. So was it worth it? Was it productive enough in our context? Or do you want to give it a second chance? But yeah, most of the time we put a cross on those that did not produce enough for us to say it's worth it, keeping on with it. So we kind of arrive to something. And for us, the big challenge is to have more variety in the botanical family that we grow, because cabbage family has always been very predominant. And because we grow a very small surface, like 1 acre, it's always something we have in mind. How can we have more of all of the other families? So that's why over the past years, we've included more squashes, herbs, or different leafy greens in order to diversify. And also getting to the acknowledgement that, yeah, cabbages, they are very well loved by their customers. And we used to grow them throughout the whole season to have always a good diversity of them. But in the summer times, they're more prone to being attacked by the flea beetles. So it requires netting. And if it's too hot or dry, they will bolt very quickly. So that this year we took the hard decision to reduce the amount of successive sowing for those quick growing brassicaceae family vegetable, and to focus more on them in the spring and fall, which is their best season for growing. So it will be like something we will need to explain to customers that they will come back in the fall, but in the summertime, enjoy heat-loving vegetables.
What heat-loving vegetables are you shifting your crop rows to?
Well, those like in the book, amaranth, Malabar spinach, we do Thai basil. We always have green onions, hot peppers, luffah, and we're trying this year more different kind of Asian squash like gourd. Hairy melon we've done in the past, and bottle gourd. So trying to harvest more also smaller size bottle gourd, a little bit like a zucchini type that you can eat very easily without peeling. I'm probably forgetting all of the new ones that we have. But last year we started trying, in French we call it liseron d'eau. I think it's water spinach in English. So it's very popular in Southeast Asia and it grew really well last year. So we'll do more of it this season.
I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit more about luffa, which is one of the ones that you just mentioned.
Luffa is really, it's one of my favorite vegetables. It does require a lot of explanation to people because a lot of people only think of the sponge. state, and many people think the sponge comes from the sea. So yeah, there's a lot of education to do about loofah. So there's mainly two types. You have the smooth loofah, which is used for making the sponge. And then you have the angular loofah, which is sweeter, so better for eating. Both of them are edible and are pretty sweet. And for eating, you should harvest when it's 1 to 2 inch thick. After that, the skin will become harder and the seeds inside will grow bigger. So it might still be edible if you peel the skin and remove the hard seeds, but it might be a bit bitter inside. So really harvest young. And it really grows like a cucumber. So will give much better result if you put a trellis so it can climb. And you can also really consider it as a cucumber. So if you want to manage it in a way to have less foliage and encourage fruit growth, it's a demanding crop that you can fertilize and yet take care like a cucumber.
And what are some of the ways that you like to prepare it?
So I really like the angular loofah. I say you can only remove the skin on the angle. So that part is the hardest. And then in between, the skin is still stuffed when it's young. And I like it steamed or baked in the oven. And it does not require a lot of cooking because it's so soft. Like a few minutes is enough. It's because it's like a sponge, right? If you cook it in a broth or in a sauce, it will really absorb flavors, or with garlic, onions, or any other fragrant ingredients. So it's not easy. It's not difficult to prepare. Actually, it's better to have it in an easy way so you can really taste it, because the taste is very subtle, very delicate. So you don't want to put too much ingredients and have it mixed with too many different flavors.
I'm definitely going to have to try that. The book also mentions that you do lacto-fermentation and make sauces and kimchi, and it includes a kimchi recipe. So I'm wondering, do you grow specific ingredients for food preservation, and what are they?
Yes, so when we started very with few recipes. We started with the kimchi and mizuna pesto, and then Asian sesame dressing. And then as the year passed, every season we had like a moment where we would have like too much cilantro or too much green onion. So we always kind of tried to develop a recipe using those ingredients in order to save them from going to compost. And so by adding those new recipes, finally, the customers really love them and kind of were expecting to find it from year to year. So now we include that into our production plan in order to always produce like the all our main products. We do napa cabbage kimchi, cucumber kimchi, daikon kimchi, white kimchi, bok choy kimchi. And then we have at least maybe 8 to 10 sauces, like different kinds of pestos, and we have green curry paste, sambal sauce with our hot peppers. So it's really a great way, I think, to preserve these vegetables when they are in the peak season, and then being able to sell them throughout the year in Christmas markets, and then during all winter, and coming also arriving in the spring. Like we start our markets second week of May, we may not have a lot of vegetables, but we still have kimchi and frozen sauces. So it's a good way to maintain the level of sales across the years and be able to predict what you will be able to sell, because you know, with vegetables, you never know if the crop will succeed or no. You're kind of very vulnerable to temperature, to insects and disease. So there's always that stress, but at least in the kitchen, you know, if I have those ingredients, I know how much jars I will make and what's the price I can sell them for. So I think it makes the farmer's work less stressful and probably more profitable, because you have an additional income.
For people who are sort of on the home garden scale and might be interested in growing some of these vegetables for food preservation, like making their own lacto ferments or their own sauces. Do you have any advice for them?
Yeah, in the book, we divided the book into season, and it starts with winter because that's the time where you sit and think about really what you want and what you can do. So being really realistic about how much time you have to dedicate to the garden, to the kitchen, and what's your goal. So if you want to make kimchi, then yeah, you can grow more Napa cabbage and plan to make your own kimchi. So get the equipment you will need for that. And we mentioned it's always something fun to do in the family or with friends. So you can plan that in the fall, you set a date where everyone comes with their vegetables, and then you make big batches of lacto ferments or jars. So yeah, because if you're by yourself, it might seem like a big chore, something that adds up to your work and burden. So we want all of that to be as more joyful as possible, because you don't want to, put everything you have this season and finally finish your season fed up and don't want to do it again next season. It becomes a way of life, so it has to get integrated into your lifestyle, and it gets to be fun.
You mentioned that you freeze some of your sauces, and I'm curious what kinds of sauces you freeze.
All of the sauces that have vegetable in them, we freeze because they're all raw. And all of our products, we don't cook nothing. For ease, but also to keep vegetables raw. So of course, lacto fermentation is a way of preserving the raw vegetable without freezing in a fridge temperature. So that's why we do a lot of lacto fermentation, especially this season. We did a lot, like pickled cucumbers, but also carrots. I lacto fermented bottle gourd, hot peppers. You can lacto ferment pretty much every vegetable. And it's really good for the gut. It has good probiotic, many beneficial bacteria. It's well documented. So it's really a good way of preserving. I'm talking about in the book because it needs some kind of care in order to do it in the right way. So you avoid having the bad bacteria developing. So that's just it. It's just a few simple things to keep in mind and to do. And then most of the time it will work well.
Great. Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Stephanie.
Thank you so much. I'm looking forward to keep in touch and maybe visit you guys in Maine someday.
This has been Common Ground Radio, which airs on the second Thursday of each month at 4 p.m. on WERU Community Radio 89.9 FM. Archives of previous episodes can be found at weru.org, as well as the WERU app. A special thanks to my guests for joining me today. I'd also like to thank the show's editor, Claire Boland. Stay tuned for more great programming.